Welcome to the homeless life, Anagarika, which means changing the lifestyle of a layperson to somebody who's gone out of the context of a layperson living in the monastery and leaving behind all kinds of things that are usually the occupation of laypersons, like in the outside in the household life, where you have all kinds of things at your disposition that actually don't exist in the monastery, things like music, TV, and all these things. It's kind of fairly easy to leave it behind if the context which one is in now doesn't actually have these things. Yet there will always be overlaps. You'll always find that there's certain areas where you're still a bit in between the two worlds, say having to do business outside in town and then coming back and then seeing the monastic environment and seeing the householder's environment from a distance. It's a transition period of trying to start the life of monasticism without the ties that one used to have. And so the first part of breaking one's ties of like what has kept one so far entertained and kept one in good spirits, now in coming to monastic life there's lots of other things that have to gradually come into one's scope of where one finds happiness with. So the main thing of becoming an Anagarika is stepping back from the worldly stuff, the worldly happiness. I find most of all like significant when one compares the 8 precepts to the 5 precepts is the breaking away or the breaking loose from occupation with sensual pleasures, which of course like for householders the Buddha doesn't prohibit. There's lots of things that are allowable out there, which then when one embarks on the homeless life and becomes a samana in the first step is very different. Many things contained in the 8 precepts are already kind of really the heart of monastic life, and it is good to take them on for some time before one takes on the ordination as a samanera or as a monk in order to see whether one fully is happy with that and sees it as a possibility to prosper and to develop the Dhamma, or whether it is something where one feels too restricted or too confined. I think many times in the monastery the 8 precepts almost keep themselves. There's little distraction, but you can watch your mind and whether it goes back to all these things like, say, whatever music, videos or entertainment one has had, or sensual pleasures. Also computers count these days to sensual pleasures, iPods, iPhones, iPads and things like that. So whether one can actually go back to nature and live simply and live peacefully without the mind always going to seek entertainment with external things. So I think the Anagarika time is a very crucial one where one can actually see whether one is content with little or content with the restrictions of monastic life. Personally, never found the restrictions as a restriction. I always found them as opening up a new possibility to live from the basic sources, and I find that's very much already a source of freedom, that one isn't dependent on all these silly things that one has been playing around with before. It means becoming really independent from all the junk that one used to accumulate in one's house, in one's room, in one's flat, or in one's life even. So just to come back to the basics, which are the path of a spiritual seeker, to live a meditative life and live a life with fewness of wishes and a life where one really values nature as it is and is able to see the benefits of living in nature and is able to see a lot what nature teaches one, which otherwise one would kind of cover up with things that are not natural, say artificial, like whatever, I don't know, bicycles, cars and gadgets and things like that. And here we live in the forest, so we have not much apart from the things that we really need. Say, we constantly reflect on using the requisites that we have to use as beings living in the world, say food, shelter, clothing, and medicines in case we're sick. And the Buddha actually reminds the bhikkhus in their ordination that there's not much more that one can expect than the basics. Living at the root of the tree, having the pamsukula jivara, the robes which has been discarded or like been used for wrapping up corpses, and then the pindapat, yeah, living on alms food, and the medicine that's made from fermented urine. So in a way we're gradually approaching these things, so taking on the life in the monastery. You're wearing a sabong and an angsa now, which is the basic garment of somebody who has gone to live the homeless life. So already that is quite a little change. And we try to integrate you as far as it is the custom with our monastic routines and the things required from living the life in the monastery. And wish you all the best so that you can really see this as a breaking free from restrictions rather than entering a cage of rules and prohibitions. We're going to talk about the Vinaya in the Pansa quite a bit. There's going to be a lot of talking about what's allowable and what not. So don't let that kind of intimidate you. Gradually coming into the monastic life, one gradually learns how to use these things as a tool. Also the same with sila, keeping sila as with the abandoning of all the things that were more or less superficial in lay life. With keeping sila in a more refined way, one actually opens up a path, one actually opens up the heart to be free for other things when there's no remorse about one's deeds and when there's no feeling of guilt or feeling of having done something that wasn't right and that has got karmic effects. Then one actually feels much more free in one's mind. One is able to develop meditation and develop wisdom. Whereas many times in lay life there's karmic bonds that one creates constantly through living on a level of more coarse ethical behavior, which draws its consequences and which really has a lot of effects. There's a whole culture around things that people simply do, and even though everybody later regrets them, they still keep doing it. Whereas now you've entered a context where the parameters are such that you won't have much regrets. If for whatever reason there are areas where you struggle with and every now and again you cannot keep the precepts, then always feel free to see it as a learning experience and take the same spirit as the monks do when they violated the precepts. They confess it to another monk, and you can confess it to anybody, any other anagarika or the monk. Just acknowledge what you've been doing and make the resolution that in the future you will be restrained. If it's anything that directly impinges on the eight precepts and it is too severe to really kind of like simply just tell somebody, then come and see me. And then we always see the acknowledgement of one's shortcomings or the insufficiencies of one's practice as growth in the Dhamma Vinaya. It's one of the famous quotes that the Buddha many times gives his monks as advice how to deal with their faults and their shortcomings, is that it is growth in the Dhamma Vinaya, seeing the danger in the things that are dangerous or seeing the fault in the things that are faulty, and making amends and making the resolution to in the future be restrained. So the monks have a fortnightly ritual for this, whereas the anagarikas don't have this. So it actually means that it's a more difficult job. If one doesn't have these rites and rituals supporting one, one has to constantly be mindful by oneself. Our general take on the rituals and the form is that it is an aid, it's like a guideline or like a road. The road is very clear, but it's also got safety barriers left and right, so if you get off the road it just bumps you back in. Whereas in case it's kind of a dirt road with unclear boundaries, or so you really have to be mindful to be staying in the middle of it. So actually it gets easier the more precepts you take. So it's not like what people out there think, where they think the less guidelines, the less restriction, that means the most freedom. It usually doesn't, because people are not ready for it. They misuse their lives in a way that it causes constant trouble and constant dukkha, constant throwing them back into the basics, which actually humans should already have mastered with their intelligence and their wisdom. Many times human beings fall back into animal behavior. They just react to their instincts, aren't capable of controlling their minds by themselves. At least we have some kind of experience, like a system of experience in a homeless life, where there's somebody who's tried most of the things that can actually happen in life, and anything from violence to sexuality and whatever, and other, of course, ethical misconduct. There's experience about it, and the Buddha put it down into these guidelines, training paths, and we just simply use it as a tool because it's been used before and it proved to be something efficient. And lay people out there, having just been back to Europe, I saw that there's little understanding that a kind of using some restraint or having some clear boundaries for oneself, be it through copying given recipes of success from others, or through self-imposed atitanas, like vows, or so, it's usually considered a silly practice, like it's something that people think is not very creative or so. But they don't understand how overwhelming it can actually be, and they don't have the refinedness of seeing how complicated things can actually get, and that it's quite sensible, reasonable to take on a given running system rather than to reinvent everything. I do believe that for somebody actually quite genius, it is quite possible to live without taking on traditions and taking on the experience of other people. Generally, I do believe that human spirit is capable of growing all by itself. But like, if there's a group of people already doing what you want to do, and if there's a group of people already warning you, this is going too far and this is going to cause you trouble, it's just most reasonable to simply take that on, rather than saying, oh yeah, no, I want to burn my fingers by myself, I won't listen to my mother, I won't listen to my father, I won't listen to my teacher, I just want to be free. And all they end up is like lots of trouble and lots of like dead ends. So we're glad that you come to take on the accumulated experience that there is in this form, and wish to support you with our experience and give you a good start in the homeless life. And the word homeless is really an ancient one, anagarika, and particularly Lungpa Liem uses it very often to humble the monks, not to think that there's something really particularly great, and just kind of saying like, yeah, homeless, we're all homeless, that's all. And we should check ourselves whether we have abandoned thoughts of the household life constantly and keep coming back to the essence of being a renunciate, somebody who leaves these things behind. Particularly if the externals aren't there, there's no TV or there's no whatever, like entertainment, no cars and things like that, whatever one used to do, or sports and things like that, then sometimes the mind proliferates. And so take this opportunity, as well as from the externals, also to work on the inside, work with meditation, work with abandoning the interest in having the mind go out to nonsensical, unuseful, superficial things, and lead a life that truly takes the nature of existence in as a training path, seeing how the body and the mind work together, how it changes, how it is liable to suffering, and how eventually there's not a single thing that you can hold on as an I, me, and yourself in that sense. So that would be an amazing experience whenever this unfolds bit by bit. The eight precepts are capable of taking people all the way to the realization of the highest truth of Buddhism. So this is something to keep in mind. So it's not a small step to take the eight precepts and to vow to take Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha as a refuge. In fact, taking vows of a triple refuge already in the time of the Buddha was the ordination itself. First, the Buddha just simply said, come bhikkhu, and then you were a bhikkhu. Then he said, take the triple refuge, or first it was actually only the dual refuge for one of them before the Sangha existed. And then gradually things got more complicated, society around the Buddha, the monks and the lay people got more and more, so he had to establish these ceremonies of Panpacha and Upasambada. So the simple truths and the simple procedures, the very meaningful, powerful steps, they are the essence of the practice. So I'm quite happy to have another member in the community that practices with the essentials. And I'd like to explain some of the details in brief again. It's customary to run through the eight precepts so that you know what we expect, because there's many standards even with the eight precepts, and there's some house rules which you'll inevitably be taught whenever there's something that we formalize. We actually really take it on to teach each other and tell each other. There's lots of little procedures that we gradually get to know. Don't let it overwhelm you, but take it as a gradual understanding of the form, and take it as an opening up of more possibilities rather than a restriction. So the first one of the eight precepts is a general precept that all Buddhists should keep, Panatipata, not to take life of any living being. Many, many tiny little creatures are making our life pretty uncomfortable in Wat Pananachat, ants, mosquitoes, and things like that, and other insects or bigger beings like snakes and things like that. So we practice tolerating their life and having a heart of loving kindness and respecting their life and not giving way to impulses or intentional thoughts or actions of killing. So that's very important. Then the second precept is to not take what has not been given. It's not only about not stealing in that sense. We have a sense of respecting other people's property. Many times there are areas where things tend to be communal, we're not quite sure. They're left somewhere, say leftover candies somewhere in it, and you'd like to have them. Just don't take them unless they're given to you. It's quite important as a principle. The monks have got the rule that anything that goes in their mouth has to go into their hands first by somebody else who gives it to them. There are other areas, like areas where possessions in the monastery sometimes are not quite clear, say books and things to take away or so. Just in case of doubt, don't go ahead, just wait and ask somebody. So it's very important as a principle not just to go ahead. Even for the monks, it is a violation of the precepts in itself to go ahead in areas that one doubts whether one is entitled to this or that. So simply to be unrestrained in that sense is already against the training rules. So just to keep one back until one's really sure that one has been given the thing or the opportunity is very much of a mental training as well. So the third precept is one that is quite important for the holy life. And it is, again, another difference to lay life, because like in lay life, in the householder's life, the third precept says gamesu michachara, which means not to have false or misconduct in the area of sensuality or sexuality. Of course, the Buddha did allow family life, but he wanted it to be clear and wanted to be having stable and clear partnerships. Not many wives, not many husbands and things like that. And for us, it's the abrahmacharya, which is embarking on the celibate life. The brahmacharya, the word brahmacharya, you will hear in many, or find in many passages in the suttas. It's just like the word samana or anagarika, just one of those very ancient terms which almost leads you to the end of the path. So to be a real brahmachari, a brahmafera, is something very high. So to abstain from violating the principles of the brahmacharya is a very big undertaking. But in the practicalities, it amounts to living as a celibate, living by yourself, living uninterested in anything that arouses sexual desire. So whether it be anything that has to do with media or with real persons, we just don't get close to it. Say, if there's magazines or newspapers or visual objects, tangible objects that arouse lust and desires. We don't touch them, we don't look at them. For the bhikkhus, they're called vatu anamasa, things not to be touched. For you as an anagarika, living still in contact with lay men, lay women, and sometimes going out into town, this is more challenging than in the monastery, where we're kind of like a bit in a sensory deprivation situation. So more or less to take this as a practice of restraint, that the eye doesn't look for these things, the ear doesn't go out for hearing these things that are kind of stimulating desires. To be content with what you have by yourself in nature, in your own body and the surroundings around you. Sometimes things do actually shift quite a bit, it's oftentimes a challenge for monastics that there's no contact to other people, then sexual contact to oneself more or less is a big issue. So in our tradition, celibacy means not to do any sexual activities with yourself, definitely not to emit semen voluntarily, which is the training rule for the monks, the Sangha di Sesa, and we see that also in the training rule number 3 as practiced in this monastery. So it's quite a severe thing to violate for the monks, so we would ask you to be very restrained with that and not even get close to anything in that area. So I think that's a bit special for the Buddhist monastic Sangha, that they take celibacy that far. I haven't heard of any other monastic traditions where the area of sexuality with oneself is completely blocked through the precepts. I think it's not as clear at all with Catholic monastics, for example. So the benefits of refraining from sexuality is that the mind is able to become more peaceful. And like, as you know, it's one of the preliminary stages of samatha, samadhi meditation, to have seclusion from sensual desires. Viviceva kamehi, vivica akusalehi damehi is what we chant when we chant the jhana factors and the Noble Eightfold Path. So it's not a trivial thing. Maybe it's possible to sometimes indulge, sometimes not out there, and when one is living one of those very highly driven lives outside in the rushed world, lots of context to stimulating things, maybe it is possible for people to suppress sexuality, to suppress it temporarily, and still be happy and still enter certain meditative states or so. But like in the long run, these things don't hold. The mind is not pleased, it's never saturated, it never finds enough. This is very much inbuilt in nature. This is inbuilt in the instincts of beings, whether it's dogs, cats, men or monks. Like, they're just never saturated with this thing. So we try to cut it off and experience a life that doesn't react on these things. And it is opening up new possibilities as well. So I encourage you to take this one very serious and then see the benefits of it, which I don't think is seen generally also in the Buddhist scene outside. There doesn't seem to be a notion of this being an obstacle, whereas you'll see when we talk about the monks' rules that to simply even have the view that sensual desires, sexual desires aren't an obstacle to peace, to Magapala Nibbana, then the Buddha even says even to have a view around this is an offense for the monks. So this is something we'll get into in the Vinaya a lot in relation to objects or people that arouse sexuality. So actually the Vinaya lessons start with that, so maybe I should cut it short. So then musavada, the area of restraining oneself in speech, not speaking anything that's false and anything that's harsh words and that's insulting or gossiping, and not to chat around nonsensical stuff like whatever, traveling here and there. And you'll find it is probably a relief not to be having to deal with all the travelers coming in that constantly bring in new ideas about where to go, where to run, which hotel, which flight, which country, which ashram, which center is better. This blah blah about where to go and chatter about this and that is highly unlikely to have much relevance in the Sangha, because we're more or less bound to be here. Specifically for the Pansa, it's even more refined. The monks shouldn't even proliferate about where to go next and which monastery to check out afterwards, because we're all here for 3 months right now. But the urge to talk and make plans, proliferate about this and that, and present ideas and whatnot, I think that's also very conducive to making the mind peaceful. And I'm quite glad that we've agreed upon having noble silence in the Sangha from the afternoon sit, which is to happen in the Pansa, and all the way until the next morning after bowl drying or after the Ovada. So generally noble silence should be in the etiquette of a samana anyway, not to talk about nonsensical, superficial things, only talk the things that are necessary, and talk words of loving kindness, words that are encouraging, that are giving support for others. That's not breaking noble silence. If somebody's in trouble, having a hard time, and you want to sit down and hear what he has to say and give him encouragement, that's not breaking noble silence. But if it goes back to this and that and here and there, what would be better, and non-monastic things, then we consider that also breaking our precepts. And then we have Sura Mera Yamacha Pamadatana, precept about refraining from intoxicants, drugs and alcohol, which should be fairly easy to keep in the monastery. We're not having access to these things unless somebody deliberately smuggles them in. This would be a ground for me to say goodbye to any candidate if there's like things like alcohol or even cigarettes, which we count as intoxicants, addictives in our monastery. So it's an absolute non-smoking area, and I do take a hardliner course on that. So if there's problems with that, I, you know, maybe give you one warning, but then afterwards that's it. Seeing the awkwardness it creates if we have the in some monasteries it's tolerated, but in Ajahn Chah's monasteries it's not. So Vikala Bhojana, not to eat in the afternoon after midday, is the precept. In the monastery we take on the Dutanga practice to have this practice more strictly. That means that we eat only once a day in one sitting, and you'll hear a lot about the etiquette around this in real life, but generally in the monastery it's very easy. If one doesn't cut the corners and take any food anywhere else than in the eating hall, that's quite easy to keep. Whereas sometimes when you go outside on a visa run, it may be a challenge more. Say there's been many people that had difficulties with that. So be aware that when you leave the monastery, you're also understood as somebody who keeps the eight precepts, and not to eat in the afternoon is well known all over the country. So you can have a bit of sense of extra embarrassment. So the fact that you've got a shaven head and you're wearing white, people know that one doesn't eat in the afternoon. And going into town or even into the internet cafes and having things that are unallowable is very much frowned upon, and usually word gets back to the monastery very quickly. I'm not sure about Suvarnakhete, but to be aware of when one goes to renew one's visa, these people also give the pakhao special honor, and particularly we have to ask the consul in Suvarnakhete a big favor to give our pakhaos a non-immigrant visa before they become novices. And if then the pakhaos on the next day are seen, say, eating ice cream in the afternoon, running around on some kind of whatever marketplace, and the consul passes by, that would be embarrassing. It hasn't happened so far, but it's just to see that there are a lot of implications, even from the punitive side of these rules. There are standards, and they're held up very high, and they're respected very high. And one is given a lot of respect and a lot of support to simply keeping this form, because everybody knows it's a very, very profound form that is the beginning of the path to liberation. So the Nachagita Varita Visukadasana is something I already commented on. It's fairly easy. We don't have these kind of devices in the monastery. Everybody's asked to give up his engagement with the computer world as well. Hand in your laptops, hand in your iPhones, iPads, and all these things, and mobile phones, and whenever you need to use the internet for undoing your ties with the world or travel arrangement, in case you want to go back, then you can simply ask for permission, and that's not a big deal. If it's for technical arrangements, Say things like YouTube is something I don't just feel monastics shouldn't have access to, or that there's not much use in it unless one gets certain whatever Dhamma teachings from that. But there's a lot of Dhamma teachings around anyway, and we practice to take the Dhamma teachings in the traditional form rather than by a certain click on a certain website, which has got lots of other implications as well. So also to give up Facebook accounts. It's very difficult to do that. I don't know whether you've been engaged with that, but I recently learned you have to unfriend everybody and then delete. So that's how you do it. Don't be a friend with worldly people anymore. Just take the real life friendship in the holy life. So no singing, no dancing, no whistling. What else can one say about these things? Every now and again, we go on trips and it may seem unrestrained or so. We're trying to find the middle way as well. We're only human beings, and having not completely embarked on the life where one derives pleasure only from meditation, every now and again you see things flaring up. So don't take them too serious, don't give them too much importance, and don't indulge, and then things will gradually kind of fade. The more one has interest in peace, the more peaceful things become, and things that have been unpeaceful before and stirring up the mind, they just kind of pass by oneself like the clouds on the sky. And I'm over the time already, but we only have one more precept, which is the eighth precept, which means to sleep on the floor, to put it blankly. We don't sleep in beds, we sleep on the floor. We don't have any particular comfort in sleeping, which is, I said this a few times already, it makes you be happy just to sleep like a dog in any corner, a sign of humility, humbleness, and you don't need much requisites for that. And it also has an effect on your whole mind, meditative attitude towards sleep. It's much easier to maintain if you don't indulge in big mattresses and blankets and things like that. Also less liable to arouse sexual desires during the night, which sometimes can be an obstacle. So to sleep on the floor is also quite healthy, and just be simple and have a mat, and that's all. And so if people get older, sometimes they have more comfort, need for comfort, which is understandable. But young and still healthy, we should take that very serious, and it makes us really easy to look after wherever we travel. We don't need much, like we don't even need a hotel room. Even in India, sleeping on the floor besides the hotel bed is kind of understandable for many people. And when I told my mother, she thought I was crazy, because the floors in the Indian hotel rooms are pretty unhygienic. So anyway, it may happen that one travels every now and again where these things come up, just like I said, in the monastery, the thing keeps itself somehow through the korwat and the things available. Outside is where you really have to take it on as your whole volition to keep these precepts. So we wish you a good start in the brahmacharya, in the anagarika life. Particularly the pansa is a good opportunity to test the form that we found is opening up all the benefits of the holy life for monastics over 2,500 years. So we wish you all the best and give you a blessing.